This is May 1st, 2011. May 1st is Labor Day in most countries that celebrate Labor Day. Maybe all other countries than ours would celebrate Labor Day. This morning I'd like to talk about boredom and the mind and separation. I was fishing through some of my millions of articles and came up with a review, a book review, in the New York Times book review. This is January of 2010, and it just sort of got me thinking about things, issues related to practice. So she starts, the author is a Jennifer Schussler, who is one of the editors at the New York Times Book Review. And she begins by saying, she writes here quite a bit as a book reviewer, from the perspective of a book reviewer. If you read a lot of book reviews, there are certain words that tend to crop up with comforting, or maybe it's dismaying, regularity. Lyrical, compelling, moving, intriguing, absorbing, frustrating, uneven, disappointing. But there's one word you seldom encounter: boring. It occurred a mere 19 times in the book review in 2009, and rarely as a direct description of the book under review. This isn't because books sent out to reviewers never turn out to be boring. Trust me on this one. Rather, boredom, unlike its equally bland, smiley-faced twin, interest, is something professional readers, who are expected to keep things lively, would rather not admit to for fear of being scolded and sent back to the weekly reader. As a general state of mind, boredom is morally suspect, threatening to shine its dull light back on the person who invokes it. More on that later. And then she quotes Oscar Wilde, "The only horrible thing in the world is ennui." Suggesting that boredom doesn't feel much better in French. That is the one sin for which there is no forgiveness. I think what Oscar Wilde was pointing to is that how much the bored person really ought to take responsibility for her or his boredom. And we'll get to that more. And she says, "And yet boredom is woven into the very fabric of the literary enterprise. We read and write in large part to avoid it. At the same time, few experiences carry more risk of active boredom than picking up a book. Boring people can, paradoxically, prove interesting. As they prattle on, you step back mentally and start to catalog the irritating timbre of the offending voice, the reliance on cliché, the almost comic repetitiousness. In short, you begin constructing a story." Okay, hold on now. This is what we, in very general terms in Zen, call separation. This stepping back and critiquing the person. And this is just bringing unnecessary misery on ourselves. This is exactly the problem behind boredom itself, is separation. You know, this word, Roshi Kapler used to use it when I first got here to the Zen Center, and I never quite got it until I went to my first sesshin, I think, and realized how reflexive. Our tendency is to separate ourselves. And what that means is to lapse into thoughts rather than just have the direct experience. This is absolutely crucial distinction in meditation practice, Zen practice certainly, is the distinction between the direct experience and thoughts about the experience. In the direct experience, there don't need to be any thoughts. It's just the hearing, just the tasting, just the seeing, the feeling, the smelling, and the thinking. In Buddhism, we count thinking as a sixth, in addition to the other five senses, the sixth sense. If there's just thinking, for their active, let's say, problem-solving, incisive thinking, that, you could say, is a kind of a direct experience in a way, somewhat like the other five senses. But it's when we allow the mind to drift into thought, kind of aimless thought, that we get into trouble, and we lose the full richness of the very experience. This is really basic stuff, but it's so important. This is what determines whether a sitting, a round of sitting, and certainly a sesshin, whether it's boring or tedious on the one hand, or not, is the amount of time we spend thinking, or really just letting the mind drift while we're sitting. So if we're, to use her example, if we're listening to someone we find boring, it's our responsibility to listen better. There are speakers and there are topics that any one of us might find boring at any given time, but it's never just the speaker. It couldn't be. It's our experience of the speaker, right? Who could argue that? And yet, linguistically, we say he's boring, or she's boring, or it is boring. We externalize. We ascribe the fault purely to that person or that thing. But there is no person or thing out there separate from us. Everything is how we experience it. Everyone is how we experience him or her. This is another real fundamental point of the Dharma. There is no thing or person out there apart from us and apart from our experience of that one. This is the premise of meditation, is by changing the mind, by changing the way we use the mind, the way we pay attention, we can change our experience of boring people or hostile people or any kind of people or experiences. So she's saying that you can, you know, really what she's saying is when you're listening to a boring person, you can distance yourself and create a narrative in your mind, a whole dialogue in your mind. And that may work up to a point. You can derive some rewards from criticizing, mentally, silently criticizing people and finding fault. You know, we do this when we're kids or teenagers. We can we're in a class and the teacher's boring or something, and then we can get into all kinds of silly, immature little mind games, and that can be a little entertaining for a while. It is no long-term solution to boredom. It is very limited, and of course, basically ill-conceived way of dealing with boredom. So how do you deal with boredom? Well, ask anyone who has sat facing a wall, a blank wall, and you know, because everyone here has sat facing a blank wall, you have to find a way to pay closer attention, to get into what you're doing. Our boredom, whenever we feel bored, this is a little signal, nice feedback mechanism that tells us we're not thoroughly paying attention. So if it's in Zendo, or you're at home, you're facing the wall, you're doing Zazen, you notice yourself getting bored, okay, that means you're separated. You're letting thoughts mediate the direct experience of breathing, counting the breath, or the breath, or the koan, whatever practice you're working on. Excellent feedback right there. Oh, I'm bored, okay. So there is no person or thing that in itself is boring. You know, just the slightest bit of reflection on this, certainly no one would argue. It's all how it is perceived, how it is experienced, and that is a function of our own mind. These are currently my favorite lines in the chant that we call Affirming Faith in Mind. We say, for things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. It is an illusion to think there are things apart from mind or mind apart from things. It's just one experience. So we need to notice when we're being critical of people or other or books or anything, if we find that's happening, and that itself is a symptom of boredom. It's a cause of boredom, and it's the symptom or the effect of boredom. That mental separation of having critical thoughts or judgmental thoughts. Now, of course, there are books and speakers and plays and movies and music that are better composed, better made. And the sign that they're better made is that they hold our attention more, or many people's attention. What some people can find interesting or even, yeah, compelling, other people might not, and vice versa. So it's not as if it's absolutely a matter of how we're paying attention, but that's a big part of it, is the degree to which we are absorbed. We find we are able to be absorbed in a person or a thing, or not. And since we can't change the movie or the book or the play or the performance, we can't change it, or even the speaker, then what can we do? Well, we take responsibility for how we're experiencing it, and we find a way to get more concentrated or attentive to the thing. Someone once said, no one is ever lonely while eating spaghetti. It takes too much attention. And I would say the same with boredom, you know. Loneliness, like boredom, comes from separation, thoughts of self and other. Okay, then to pick up where she left off, she was suggesting that you can create this this little thing in your mind if you find someone who's boring. She says, but a boring book, especially a boring novel, is just boring. A library is an enormous repository of information, entertainment, the best that has been thought and said. It is also probably the densest concentration of potential boredom on earth. And then she does a little retrospective. Boredom, like the modern novel, was born in the 18th century and came into full flower in the 19th century. She just talks about, traces the arising, the origin of the word boring, and it's how it became to be used. I'll skip over that. Boredom, scholars argue, was something new, different from the dullness, lassitude, and tedium people had no doubt been experiencing for centuries. In her ingenious study, now here's where we come to this reviewer's the book she was reviewing, the literary history of a state of mind. Boredom, the literary history of a state of mind. Patricia Meyer Spax describes it as a luxury and a peril born of the Industrial Revolution, reflecting the rise of individualism, leisure, and the idea of happiness as a right and a daunting personal responsibility. Then she quotes the author, boredom presents itself as a trivial emotion that can trivialize the world. It implies an embracing sense of irritation and unease. It reflects a state of affairs in which the individual is assigned ever more importance and ever less power. And this reminds us that if you divide experience into, this is done in Buddhist texts, if you divide experience into the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral, that boredom is, of course, unpleasant by definition. And it's, to use another word, it's painful in a very faint, light way. It is a painful, unpleasant experience. And in that sense, we can respond to it as we do with physical pain. While sitting, let's just for now stick to the sitting. When we notice physical pain while we're sitting, pain in our knee, our ankle, our back, or wherever, what do? We can separate ourselves from the direct experience of the pain and think about it and strategize and analyze. And somehow we can flee into thoughts about the pain. That's not going to work. The other way, which does work, is to become one with the pain. We do that becoming one with the practice. It's the same thing. When you're one, let's say, with the breath, your practice is following the breath. If you feel pain in your knee, and you renew your efforts to become one with the breath, then that's a way of becoming one with the pain. And then we find that the pain can become more manageable, it can become actually diminished, our experience again. It's all about our experience of it. There's no pain out there, just as there's no boredom out there. There's no pain, no physical pain. It's all determined by the mind. So boredom is a painful state. And what almost everyone finds through extended periods of sitting, when pain is more likely to come up if you're sitting for long periods of time, such as in Sesshin, what you find is that the physical discomfort of that little bit of ache in your ankle or your knee, that physical discomfort can function. You can use it as a lever, like a pry pole, to get deeper into the breath or whatever one's practice is. This is a wonderful discovery when we realize that we can use the pain. We can use the physical pain. We can use the boredom. It's kind of a way to, admittedly, it's a way to get out of the pain or the boredom, is to become one with the practice or with whatever we're doing. It works. So we certainly do have responsibility whenever we're in any kind of unpleasant situation. And she goes on, in Saul Bellow's Humboldt's Gift, must be a novel, the narrator, a writer who spends the final Eisenhower, here she quotes this, who spends the final Eisenhower years trying to write the definitive treatise on boredom, describes it as a kind of pain caused by unused powers, the pain of wasted possibilities or talents, accompanied by expectations of the optimum utilization of capacities. Kind of boring sentence. But boredom may itself be a highly useful human capacity, at least according to some psychologists and neuroscientists who have begun examining it not just as an accomplice to depression and addiction, but as an important source of creativity, well-being, and our very sense of self. Researchers have discovered that when people are conscious but doing nothing, for example, lying in an MRI scanner waiting to be given some simple mental task as part of a psychology experiment, the brain is in fact firing away with greater activity in regions responsible for recalling autobiographical memory, imagining the thoughts and feelings of others, and conjuring hypothetical events. The literary areas of the brain, you might say. Now this, many people will recognize, is what can happen when we are facing that blank wall in the Zendo or at home. And what comes up are these very things sometimes. Recalling autobiographical memory, imagining the thoughts and feelings of others, and conjuring hypothetical events. And it occurred to me that this may be why some people report that they find it harder to be concentrated while sitting than while moving. I do hear this from time to time. I have for many years. And beginners seem to, I don't know, maybe. My memory is that it's more beginners than experienced people. For example, workshop people will say with some wonder at lunch, boy, I found it harder to be concentrated while sitting than while doing the walking, the Kinhin meditation. And then other people say they find that they seem to be less concentrated while sitting than while doing in their daily activities. I've always said that I think it's because when we're sitting, we're just more acutely aware of thoughts. Because we have nowhere to run and nowhere to hide from our thoughts, they're just in our face. When we're driving or doing this or doing that, it's easier to not notice the level of thoughts that are going on in the mind. But when we're sitting facing a wall, then they can become quite glaring, quite conspicuous. And that's true. I have no question about that. But here is this neurological report that when we're conscious but doing nothing, in other words, not doing, the brain is in fact firing away with greater activity in regions responsible for these things we mentioned. I've often reassured people that people also come and report sometimes after they've been sitting for 3 months or 6 months that they seem to be less concentrated, just generally. They seem to be less concentrated than they were when they began their practice. And I believe in this case something similar actually is at work, which is we become more aware of the background noise that didn't used to be aware of. In Tibetan Buddhism, I heard they have a stage of practice called the stage of cascading thoughts. And it's not the first stage of practice. And I think it's the same. It's the same explanation is our awareness has developed. We're becoming more aware of what's going on in the mind. People without any meditation practice tend to be completely oblivious about what's going on in the mind because they're so caught up in external things. But when we stop ourselves, we stop, sit unmoving, facing a wall, then we can no longer ignore the tumult in the mind. And as time goes by, it becomes more and more noticeable. Luckily, we also learn to not get involved with it. We learn that more and more as we go on. So it's not like it just becomes this growing cacophony in the mind as the months or years go by. We discover that there can be the thoughts, but that doesn't mean we have to do anything about them. And when we learn that, not to get involved with the thoughts, then they are no longer a problem. We can notice them. There's the noticing of the thoughts, but that doesn't mean we have to linger in them and feel badly about them. She goes on, when this so-called default mode network is activated, and now again she's talking about when the mind, when we're conscious but not doing anything, when this network is activated, the brain uses only about 5% less energy than it does when engaged in basic tasks. But that discrepancy may explain why time seems to pass more slowly at such moments. Now, here's another thing, this matter of time and noticing the passing of time. I've often been asked over the years, how do you know when you're getting better at this practice? How do you know when you've had a good sitting? Well, you might ask whether you even need to know, but just taking the question in its own terms, the only reliable measure I've ever come up with is sort of in the negative, that if time seems to be dragging, if that round, that half-hour round of sitting, if it seems to go on forever, then that's a pretty reliable sign that you're not very concentrated, you're not very absorbed in your practice. The opposite isn't necessarily true. You can be sitting and you can be lost in some storyline in your mind, rehearsing something you're going to say to someone, or replaying a tape from what someone said to you the day before. You can be completely apart from the breath and lost in this whole narrative in your mind, and time can pass pretty fast. So it's really just in the negative that we can venture to evaluate our degree of concentration on the practice, and that is if time doesn't drag. And that's another feedback signal, is when time is really going by slowly. And that, of course, is boredom. And then this thing about the brain in this quiet mode is only using about 5% less energy than it does when engaged in basic tasks. She says, it may also explain the agitated restlessness that compels the bored to seek relief in doodling or daydreaming. And we can see how closely related restlessness is to boredom. It's a restless mind. When we let the mind settle through deeper absorption in the practice we're working on, then we lose some of that restlessness. She goes on, it's common to decry our collective phasophobia, which means fear of boredom, manifested. It's common to decry our fear of boredom manifested in our addiction to iPhone apps, the cable news crawl, and ever mutating varieties of multitasking. One cell phone company has even promoted the idea of micro boredom, which refers to those moments of inactivity that occur when we're, say, stuck waiting in line for a latte without our BlackBerry. But novelists, for all their own fears of being dismissed as boring, continue to offer some bold resistance to the broader culture's zero-tolerance boredom eradication program. Let me just pause and note that there's something really very profound shift in our popular culture when we have so many ways of avoiding silence. It is so easy when we're having a moment of boredom or restlessness just to go to the smartphone or the internet or whatever kind of electronic form of diversion and escape that presents itself. There are things that's so easy to do that now. People can spend years, or I don't know, maybe their whole life, just avoiding the boredom or the silence. It's really a very sad thing, because it's a tremendous opportunity lost when we always will paper over these moments with just busily occupying the mind with this or that. It's natural that people want to do it who wants to just be standing in line, shifting from one leg to the other, and looking at your watch. So it's natural that we would only use these things, but it's a kind of a Faustian bargain, really. Because we're missing the opportunity to dig deeper into ourselves and develop qualities that will enable us to get beyond the whole phenomenon of boredom. Again, sitting, this is it. This is why people who sit have reached such a have evolved to such an important point in their consciousness, that they're willing to put themselves into this potentially most boring of all situation, because it implies or it testifies to their faith in the practice. All right, I'm willing to sit in this, you know, uncomfortable posture facing a blank wall. That is a great testimony to their faith they can get through the possible boredom. Which, of course, you can. Of course you can. The person, people without any experience with sitting, they hear about your being in a retreat for 10 hours a day, facing the wall and no talking, and they just almost flabbergasted that anyone could endure such boring circumstances. But what you find is, when you get into the, become one with the practice, that it just, doors fly open and you can have the most stirring discoveries about oneself and the way the world is in these circumstances. And then she talks about an upcoming book. At the time it was coming out, David Foster Wallace's The Pale King, a novel about the inner lives of number-crunching IRS agents. And then she said an excerpt that appeared last year in The New Yorker depicts a universe of micro-boredom gone macro. And then this is a passage from Wallace's book. He did another return. Again, the math squared, and there were no itemizations on 32, and the printout's numbers for W-2 and 1099 and forms 2440 and 2441 appeared to square, and he filled out his codes for the middle trays 402 and signed his name and ID number. Again, I have to say, some people would not find that boring doing that. They would find it compelling. People work in different ways. People have different kinds of minds. And that could be, some people doing that, time could fly by in no time. It just like that. Because it can be very absorbing. And then finally she says, for all the mundanity of its subject matter, the excerpt presents boredom as something more strenuous and exalted than the friendly helper depicted by the neuroscientists, keeping our minds revved up even when we think we're idling. Boredom isn't just good for your brain, it's good for your soul. Well, everything I've said this morning would contradict that. But let's understand it in the way that she means it. It's good for your soul. And then she quotes Wallace again. Bliss, a second-by-second joy and gratitude at the gift of being alive, conscious, lies on the other side of crushing, crushing boredom. This is what we're just saying, that the facing a blank wall, if we can stick with it, then we can experience bliss, a second-by-second joy and gratitude of the gift of being alive. It's true. And then Wallace continues, pay close attention to the most tedious thing you can find. And then he has in parentheses, tax returns, televised golf. The most tedious thing you can find, that would be for, on the face of it, that would be Zazen. And in waves, a boredom like you've never known will wash over you and just about kill you. Ride these out, and it's like stepping from black and white into color. Like water after days in the desert. Instant bliss in every atom. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.